Welcome to Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this month's episode, Dr. Christine Smith. Today, we're discussing an interesting clinical letter recently published in IFAR titled Evaluating the Potential Infectious Risk Profile of Biologics in Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyps by Dr. Lee Sowerby and his colleagues. As biologic therapies continue to transform the treatment of chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps, we're becoming increasingly comfortable with their efficacy, but the questions about their long-term safety remain just as important. This paper takes a closer look at one of those questions. Do biologics, particularly the newest agent targeting thymic stromal lymphopoietin, or TSLP, carry a higher risk of infection? To explore this, the authors review the major randomized control trials of biologics used in CRS with nasal polyps, including dupilumab, mepolizumab, omalizumab, benralizumab, depemokimab, and the recently published Waypoint trial of tezepelumab. They pooled all the reported infectious adverse events to compare overall infectious risk across these studies and drugs. Their key finding was that, unlike the other biologics, the pooled infectious adverse events reported in the Waypoint study produced an odds ratio of 2.78 for the infection compared with the placebo. Importantly, serious infections were uncommon, and the data from the asthma trials of tezepelumab have not demonstrated the same signal. Dr. Sowerby and his co-authors emphasize in the paper that this represents a potential safety signal that deserves continued vigilance, long-term surveillance, and further study as this therapy enters broader clinical practice. Today, I'm joined by the paper's senior author, Dr. Lee Sowerby, joining us from Western University from Canada, to discuss why the team undertook this analysis, how they interpreted these findings, and what rhinologists should take away when counseling patients on biologic therapy.
Thanks so much for having me, Christine. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this paper.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining me. I'd love to start with the motivation behind this work. The rhinology community has understandably been focused on how effective biologics are, but this paper shifts the conversation towards safety. What prompted your group to ask this question?
That's a great question. So, you know, for me, my first awareness of TSLP, or, you know, as we hear our allergy and respirology colleagues call it, TSLP, was actually from Martin de Rossier. And I remember seeing him present a poster presentation at a conference where he had postulated that there may be a impaired ability to fight viruses. I don't think that paper ever made it into publication, but it certainly planted a seed in my head, as it was kind of in that pre-biologic era when we were first starting to look at potential targets for biologic therapy.
Thank you. It does seem that one of the intentions of this paper was to look more closely at tezepelumab, which, as you mentioned, is this anti-TSLP therapy. Could you explain what TSLP actually does in the immune system and why blocking it might theoretically raise concerns about infection?
Sure. So, you know, it's funny. I first off want to preface this by saying I am by no means a immunologist, as all of us rhinologists have been kind of dragged into this and becoming much more knowledgeable about this part of our field. I've been learning as I go. And, you know, the more you learn, it's like the peeling off the layers of an onion. The further you go, you find out the more and more there is to learn. So, you know, TSLP is really an upstream alarm. And with that, there's lots of downstream effects that kind of come from that. It's a key component and driver in type 2 inflammation. With TSLP, there's actually two different forms. So there's a short form and a long form. And tezepelumab targets specifically the long form of TSLP, which then, again, is implicated primarily in that T2 cascade. Now, interestingly, that long form, it does have a role in activating CD8 plus. And so in order for that to happen, it has to bind to our heterodimeric receptor complex, which is the TSLP receptor chain and IL-7 receptor alpha. And it's only the long form that's actually capable of binding to those. Under resting conditions, the native CD8 positive T cells don't express that, but it's a highly dynamic situation where as they start being activated, it binds directly to that the TSLPR as well as the IL-7 receptor alpha on the CD8 cell, which then triggers the phosphorylation of STAT5, which then upregulates BCL2, which then enhances CD8 T cell survival expansion, and then ultimately helping us with fighting viral infections. I know that's a lot.
I feel like it's inevitable that when we talk about these biologics, we talk about what some of us fondly call the confusogram of all those different immune pathways. And I think this really highlights how complex this system of inflammation is and how it's not just limited to the inflammatory pathway, but also the immune system as well. So thanks for explaining that.
Yeah, I find it's really interesting. You know, there's also, even with cancer homeostasis, both eosinophils and TSLP are implicated in that. And, you know, one of the other parts of my practice is in actually treating skin cancer. And we sometimes will use calcipotriol to potentiate 5-fluorouracil. And calcipotriol upregulates TSLP. And that's the potentiating factor that helps with, you know, the treatment of superficial squamous cell carcinoma in situ, or like actinic keratoses. And so, you know, there's all these effects that are related to this part of the immune system that, you know, if we get trapped, we kind of think of it very narrowly as, you know, only implicated in this like type 2 inflammation that causes asthma and chronic sinusitis polyposis. But there's so many other avenues within this.
Yeah, I can see why you and your team wanted to ask this question. And one of the things I really appreciate about this paper is that it doesn't focus solely on tezepelumab. You essentially reviewed all the landmark biologic trials in CRS with nasal polyps. Why did you decide to focus on these landmark trials?
So as I mentioned, there's always that potential for others' findings there within the trials that may have been missed. I will credit Philippe Gavertz, my co-author on this paper, who prompted us to do this and said, listen, you know, we really should look at everything. And it was on his prompt that we did. And I'm glad that we did, because as you said, it really helps us kind of provide a more broad survey over the lay of the land. I've been involved in a number of the biologic trials, and I find the reporting of the adverse events is quite interesting, because the definition of what you would consider, you know, like an upper respiratory tract infection or nasopharyngitis depends on the trial and how that definition is defined. And some of that also ties back to how the FDA defines those conditions. Mm-hmm. And so in Waypoint, nasopharyngitis versus an upper respiratory tract infection was really distinguished on the investigator's reported adverse event term. And so if the term that was used was like common cold or common cold viral infection or cold-like symptoms, those were actually coded as nasopharyngitis. Now, I don't know about you, Christine, but I've never diagnosed a patient with nasopharyngitis clinically, but it is something you'll see recurring in all of these biologic trials as a adverse event that can be reported. For those where they were thinking more like an upper respiratory tract infection, if it was coded as viral upper respiratory infection or upper respiratory tract cold with nasal symptoms or bacterial upper respiratory tract infection, those were all coded as a URTI. Now, that coding can also differentiate between studies, but you can see in parsing those out as individual adverse events, it's not necessarily really fair, but they're also things that, you know, may or may not even be related. You know, as you know, sometimes patients present and they say they have a cold, but it's actually, you know, their allergic rhinitis is happening because every May they have a cold or they have, you know, a sinus infection. And so I think that's one of the weaknesses with clinical trials is that, you know, really any sort of adverse event gets reported and pooled, which is why, you know, when this study, we tried to kind of pool them all together as infectious adverse events.
Yeah, I think putting that together as a broad picture rather than a single snapshot is really helpful. And it's great to have your insight into the background about how that adverse event reporting works in the clinical trials. I did notice that you included two other tezepelumab trials, Catnip and Destination, which look at allergic rhinitis and severe asthma, respectively. Why did you decide to include these non-CRS studies in your review?
You know, we're fortunate in that most of the studies that happen in chronic sinusitis with nasal polyposis have usually already gone through asthma for both safety and efficacy. In this case, it was nice to have other studies looking at tezepelumab to see if we were seeing like a persistent safety signal there with these infectious adverse events. And, you know, we were quite reassured to see that we were in fact not seeing it in those two other studies.
That's a great segue to take us to talk about the finding that I think will have caught everyone's attention. In the Waypoint trial, the risk of an infectious adverse event was significantly increased in the tezepelumab group with an odds ratio of 2.76. This is quite different than the results of the other biologics trials. Can you tell us a little bit more about what type of infectious events were seen in these patients?
Yeah. So when you look at the serious adverse events that were reported were like, you know, appendicitis, a pneumonia, there was an E. coli, UTI, bacterial sepsis, encephalitis. And those were basically the same between tezepelumab and placebo, with 5 serious infectious adverse events with tezepelumab and 4 in the placebo group. But it was more when we looked at the mild or moderate adverse events, where we were looking at pharyngitis, influenza, a viral upper respiratory tract infection, COVID-19, nasopharyngitis, upper respiratory tract infection. And, you know, really when Waypoint first came out, the reason why we decided to look at this more was when I saw these adverse events come up, like all of the numbers in the tezepelumab column were higher than the numbers in the placebo group. And so the total adverse events when we're looking, comparing both with those infectious etiologies, was 137 in the tezepelumab group versus 87 in the placebo group.
Yeah, that's definitely a difference. When you look at the catnip and destination studies, which also look at tezepelumab in allergic rhinitis and asthma, this increased risk of infectious adverse events wasn't seen. Why do you think we see all of these increased events in the Waypoint study, but not these two?
So I think for that, it really comes back to the timing of the study. You know, the Waypoint study happened during the pandemic and as we came out of the pandemic. And, you know, for many of the people who are tuning in here, I'm sure we all experienced that, you know, upsurge as everything opened back up again with, you know, the complicated sinusitis with we had like an insane number of orbital and intracranial complications from upper respiratory tract infections in kids, especially. And then it kind of settled back down. And so I think, unfortunately, for Waypoint, it happened where it was kind of at the tail end of that COVID-19. So there was some increased COVID-19 events. And then there was this capture of kind of that immediate reemergence into normal life where we saw a difference there. And it may have something, again, that immunologists may have more insight as to how or why an anti-TSLP agent would have an effect on that. But I am reassured, like I said earlier, by the fact that we did not see a similar safety signal in the other tezepelumab trials that we looked at.
So overall, when we look at these results, which reported this increased odds ratio for the infectious adverse events in patients with CRS with nasal polyps being treated with tezepelumab, what do you think this means? And perhaps just as importantly, what doesn't it mean?
I think it's something just to be, you know, peripherally aware of. It would be something where, you know, I think let's say you have like an elementary school teacher who has a history of having acute exacerbations of their chronic sinusitis and they're on Waypoint. I think if you're seeing that they're continuing to have increased acute exacerbations, then it may be worth looking at putting them on a different biologic. Again, I don't think we necessarily have good enough evidence to say that for sure, but it's more just about kind of planting the seed and having some peripheral awareness that there may be an implication here for that. With the other trials looking at tezepelumab, I think, you know, we don't need to apply that broadly across all of our patients or to be concerned that there is, you know, a true safety signal with the medication here. But much like with all of the other biologics, you know, we don't know what happens with 10 or 20 year therapy. I continue to be concerned with the potential implications with any of our, you know, anti-IL-5 agents with the eosinophil depletion, that, you know, we know the role for the eosinophil in cancer biology is incredibly complex. And we don't really know what happens long-term with that inhibition, much like with this inhibition of TSLP. And again, it's very focused on the long form of TSLP, but we still don't know really kind of what the long-term implications are of inhibiting that alarmin at the epithelial barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think you've mentioned something along these lines, but I think it would be really easy to look at these results and see the increased odds ratio in the Waypoint study and conclude that this medication may be less safe. How do you think we should interpret that or approach it?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we have enough evidence to really make that conclusion. To me, I think it's very reassuring when we look at all of the other safety signals within it. My primary critique of all of our, you know, phase 3 clinical trials is that the safety window really is that it's a 52-week study with some extension that sometimes is out to, you know, 6 months afterwards, but that's it. Right. And so we don't see kind of what happens beyond that. And, you know, much like we saw with dupilumab, is we're starting to see other things like psoriasis that, you know, comes up in some patients where it's like, you know, you have the type 2 inhibition that happens, and then you start having like a type 1 overdrive where they can end up with issues. I've had one patient myself, and, you know, fortunately that reversed for them once they switched off dupilumab. And then, you know, there was the question about, you know, is there a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which seems to have been put to bed. But again, it's planted a seed that, you know, we need to, I think, be aware of these rare events. And, you know, ultimately, I think if we had a better way of collecting that those rare events or occurrences within our patients, we'd have a way of capturing that data to see if there are safety signals that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, I agree. I think having a way to collect those post-trial adverse events would be really helpful to give us more information. Will the results of this study or of the Waypoint study change how you counsel your patients when you're discussing the biologics we should be using?
I don't think so. You know, to me, it's more just one of those things that I'm going to be aware of. And if I am seeing any signs where I think that there's, you know, more frequent viral infections, that I'll be looking to switch a patient off that. I don't think it's necessarily something that needs to be included in our consent discussions or anything like that. But it's more just kind of like, again, just planting the seed of saying, hey, listen, like, let's just be, you know, aware of this and see if we're seeing a signal here.
Along those lines, should we be changing anything in our monitoring as clinicians?
Yeah, again, I don't think so. I think for most people, you know, that interval follow-up of, you know, every 3 months or so is probably enough to be monitoring our patients. I don't think there's any necessary blood work. And again, we're quite fortunate in that with a lot of these medications, by the time they come to us, there's already fairly well-established clinical experience with our respirology and our allergy colleagues. And so, you know, when I talk about this with my colleagues with respirology and allergy, they don't think that they're seeing a signal here. They're not seeing, you know, more acute infectious exacerbations in their patients. And on the whole, they seem to have been quite satisfied with the response to tezepelumab that they're seeing in severe asthmatic patients.
What about the role of vaccination in all of this?
So, you know, that's a good question. There actually was a study that was done looking at that. So there was a phase 3B study called the Vector study that specifically looked at tezepelumab in patients with moderate to severe asthma. And they demonstrated actually that there was a robust, unimpaired humoral antibody response to the quadrivalent influenza vaccine. And so that seems to be good. You know, we with many of these things in all the clinical trials, any of the live attenuated vaccines were suggested to be avoided. And I think clinically, that is still the idea. We don't know. There is a theoretical risk of impaired viral clearance with it, or perhaps even an exaggerated response to the strain. The reality is, once medications like tezepelumab are used clinically, you end up having patients that receive these things. And you know, if there was a safety signal there, we would hope that we would be seeing that from those reported adverse events. But again, we need clinicians to be reporting the adverse events if they do occur and making that connection between the two.
And then what lingering questions do you have about the real-world risks of tezepelumab in CRS and nasal polyps? What additional information or studies would you like to see? I know you mentioned the idea of recording all those adverse events.
Yeah, you know, I think, and this is the challenge, right, is that, you know, when you look at any reporting of adverse events of medications, the onus really is on the clinician to do the heavy legwork of reporting those events. And ultimately, we should. If we're not reporting those events, then we don't really have any place where we can be collecting that information in databases that allow us to further evaluate and analyze it to see if there is safety signals that we need to be aware of. You know, for these infectious things with a viral infection, these were all mild things that we saw in when we looked at the Waypoint data. You know, we were talking about really what were, I assume, colds, right? Maybe COVID-19. But the more concerning thing to me is those rare events of, like, you know, if we are starting to see a cancer signal with these, the only way we're going to find that is if we have some sort of database where we're going to be able to, you know, query it and find those rare signals, which puts the onus on us as clinicians to make sure that we are reporting when our patients have these. And the problem sometimes is that you may not make the link between, you know, your patient developing like colon cancer and the fact that they're on a biologic for their chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps.
Yeah, those are hard stories to tell, particularly when they're spread out over a really long amount of time. So I think that's a great idea. Thank you so much for taking the time to discuss your paper with me today. As we get ready to wrap up, if listeners could only take away one message from today's conversation, what would you want it to be?
I think it's just we need to be aware that, you know, for biologics, and I know to our most of our audience, for the rhinologists, you know, we're very judicious in who we put on biologics, and we really kind of reach the end of therapeutic options for them. I feel sometimes we see patients who've been placed on biologics, perhaps before they've had a chance of, you know, complete sinus surgery with really good topical therapy, or, you know, the diagnosis may not have even been made correctly of chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps. And that's where I think we need to be judicious in our biologic use. You know, these medications are amazing in the right patients, but we don't know what our long-term safety data is for these. For all intents and purposes, they look like very safe medications, but we don't know that definitively yet. And I think that, you know, for us as clinicians, we need to have that spidey sense of, you know, if somebody comes in and says that, you know, they've got a new rash, that it may well be related to their biologic, or, you know, if they have a cancer or something like that, then I think we need to be reporting those things so that, you know, the next generation of researchers are going to be able to query those in the database and see those very rare safety signals.
I think it's important to remember that when we're prescribing a systemic medication, we have to treat a systemic patient. And as much as I love to say, oh, I'm just a nose doctor now and I don't do these other things, when we take on the responsibility of treating this, you know, sometimes systemic inflammatory disease, we have to monitor for those other complications as well.
Exactly.
Well, congratulations to you and your team on your publication, and thank you for bringing us this interesting topic today. To our listeners, thank you for joining us for another episode of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. If you enjoyed today's discussion, please be sure to read Dr. Sowerby's full clinical letter. This is Christine Smith, signing off until next time.